Has everyone read at least the first chapter of this? How many found it interesting? How many found it valid? Okay. So, why we are reading a book called Spirit in Ashes, Hegel, Heidegger, and Man-Made Mass Death, is because we are, of course, on the brink of imminent planeticide, a mass death of a kind unprecedented in this cycle of time, the real apocalypse is upon us. And therefore, it behooves us to have an authentic and a valid and an accurate understanding of the full significance of this death event that we are in, because it's already underway. Edith Wishegrad, who wrote the book, I think she died in 2009, if I'm not incorrect. But this book was, of course, written, I think, in the 80s and before the COVID or any of the current issues had reached anything near the kind of strength and imminence and horror that is now our everyday situation. And as she says in the prologue, people had become somewhat immune to believing in the apocalypse because nuclear weapons had been around for so long, since 1945. No nuclear war had happened, so, you know, people would be too intelligent to do something like that, in which there's no winner and there's no way that we would fall into such a situation of a pointless conflict between superpowers, etc. But of course, that's only one aspect of it, as she points out. The death world that she refers to, of slave labor camps, and of course the infamous camps in World War II, and that whole situation is now, of course, again being faced in many parts of the world with sanitary camps for people with COVID who need to be quarantined, et cetera, all of that in quotes, of course. But these are concentration camps, and of course many are being built that have not yet been fully employed, but they are being employed. Australia has already been rounding up Aboriginals and others. Other camps are happening in China, of course, and in other parts of the world, and they're being readied for use in the U.S. and Europe. And so these situations of imminent catastrophic loss of all of the meaningful structures of life that we take for granted are about to be taken away as the food shortages hit and the other aspects of this engineered global destruction. And a point that I think is essential for us to understand is that none of this could have happened if not millions of people choosing to be accomplices of it. Millions of doctors who knew better, who went along with it, millions of nurses, millions of pharmacists, who all knew better but didn't want to lose their jobs, or the money that they might have been bribed and in some cases been intimidated, and in some cases some did apparently lose their lives. And so people were intimidated to go along with this, and they did, and they have, except for very few exceptions. And the same with lawyers, for the most part, politicians, obviously, the mainstream media, obviously, all of the accomplices to this mass death, a huge percentage of the population had to go along for this to have come this far. And the same true with the supply lines being cut and the engineered food shortages and all of that. And although there are some resistances, as we're seeing in the Netherlands recently and before, the truckers in Canada, etc., but to almost no avail, because the will, the political will, is not strong enough to overcome the tyranny of this choice of mass death that is even now underway and still being denied by most of the population, although apparently people are starting to wake up as their friends and relatives keel over, and we see people giving speeches and falling dead in the middle of talks and on TV and on sporting fields, etc. And so it's very difficult to hide, but denial is very strong, and people can witness these things and still somehow not change their paradigm, which is, I think, an extraordinary symptom of what may well be the root cause of this whole situation, which is human inauthenticity. And so that's why I thought that her choice of pegging the book around what she's calling the authenticity paradigm, I think, is very interesting. And specifically, I would say, the inauthenticity is a human flight from death, a denial of death. There's even a famous book by that name, but in a culture of narcissism and of puer eternus complexes, right? People who want to stay youthful, children their whole lives and never grow up, death is denied. And it's for that reason that so many millions fell into the trap of, as soon as the apparent virus was announced, that they ran to stand in line for their injections because of fear of death. Even though the mainstream news even said very few people will die of this, it's like a flu, you know, it has hardly any significant mortality, and yet people lined up for an experimental injection and are now gradually, some suddenly, and some still to come, paying the price. And so the fear of death and the desire to remain uncontaminated by the germ of death, even though that is clearly impossible and inauthentic in its own right, obviously, has been one of the engines that enabled this pandemic to succeed to the extent that it has. However, having said that, I want to say something about the book with all due respect to Edith Visegrad, whom I wish would graduate from the cycle of time. And she has contributed a lot as an academic. But this book itself reeks with inauthenticity. I consider almost everything said in this book to be totally invalid. And I want to go through that with you. And yet, its inauthenticity as an academic text, and remember, academics have to tiptoe around all kinds of taboos. You're not allowed to really say anything. You quote other people who said things, but you don't actually come out and say anything yourself, right? And she doesn't. And not only that, but if you really read closely, which I assume you have, she will, in the same paragraph, contradict herself. She'll say one thing, and then and two sentences later, she'll say exactly the opposite. This is the most wishy-washy writing I've ever encountered. The book is utterly useless in understanding authenticity because her version of the authenticity paradigm is totally inauthentic. And we'll go into that. She makes it about the moment of death, that you have a good death. But it's about the art of living in truth. It doesn't really have to do with death. An authentic life has to do with facing truth. And indeed, facing truth includes facing the truth of our death and being saturated with the presence of that death, not running away from it. And to be saturated with the presence of death means to be saturated with the presence of conscience. Because when you die, you face a judgment, whether it's the final judgment or a judgment that one has to deal with in between each lifetime, and one does. And this is evidenced even in the near-death experiences, but it's clear, and it's an inherent aspect of the terror of death that is embedded in the soul. And the ego has a very difficult time making an authentic distinction between conscience in the real and the superego. Because your superegos can make you feel guilty and shameful and all of that. But that's not the same as your conscience speaking. And that distinction also has to be authentically derived from one's experience. And so why would I let you read a book that I think is totally invalid? It's not sadism, actually, and it's not to attack her either. I have actually great respect for her. But it's a symptom of the inauthenticity of human discourse at the end of Kali Yuga. And that authenticity cannot be found within the normal range of human conversation, intercourse of a symbolic kind, a meeting of minds. The constructs have become so dissociated from the real that it's very difficult to speak authentically. In fact, I would say the great spiritual traditions, their main focus is on how to communicate authentically and coherently. If you think about it, what are the Zen masters doing, you know, when they're hitting each other or screaming or shouting or punching each other in some way or telling riddles or threatening to kill each other's cats or whatever they're doing, right? There's all kinds of these Zen stories, but what are they trying to do? They're trying to transmit truth authentically. And language, for the most part, is a barrier to the transmission of truth. It's not an instrument or a vehicle of truth. It's a vehicle for putting up defenses against truth, for the most part. So when we are dealing with the end of the world and the flight from death, that I would say has caused death to have to appear in such a massive way, because we have massively, as a species, been running away from death, and now it has caught up with us, and we have nowhere to run. And it's the facing of death that I think most of the, at least in, let's take just the first chapter, is really about. And I think she was very wise in choosing Rilke as her foil here, because Rilke may well be the last of the great poets who was still attempting to be authentic. She calls him a postmodern poet, but that in itself is inauthentic. He's a modernist at best. We're he was in the early, before World War I, and World War I itself is, the, in a way, the cutoff point, I think, for the authenticity, the urge to be able to speak the truth from one's heart, without it having to be coded or in some way metaphorized, and not able to be directly addressed. And so I would like to use some of these meetings to actually go more deeply into Rilke, because I think he holds the key for us in what he said, in some of the quotes that you've probably read already in here, of living with death inside of one and living in both the emptiness of the ego and the emptiness of the life of the ego, but also the fullness of what death really is, which is the presence of God. And the presence of God not filtered by ignorance or denial or any of the mechanisms that the ego has of diverting attention from the power of the presence of the real and of truth. So I think that the book, we can also use it as an opmanologist would in meeting with a client and listening to their narrative and being able to observe where they are being inauthentic and how someone can speak to one inauthentically and yet with total urgency and yearning and earnestness and every sense that they are being authentic or striving to be, and that that very striving can be what is hiding the unspoken and the unspeakable that is creating the suffering and the agony within the speaker and the listener of such discourse. So she starts with a quote by Wittgenstein that the earlier culture will become a heap of rubble and finally a heap of ashes, but spirits will hover over the ashes. I doubt that. At the end of the world, the spirits will not be hovering over the ashes. They will be long gone. There are spirits now hovering in the atmosphere. But they're hovering here now because they can't go to the light and they can't reincarnate because there aren't any more bodies for them to reincarnate. Enough have died and the birth rate is now so low that most of those who are dying now cannot get back into bodies except by possessing the bodies of others as ghosts and obsessing spirits. But they are not... they're not transcending. But once the singularity comes, there will be neither ashes nor spirits to hover over them. And so for her, as we go into the preface, she's saying that the deepest wound is that of nuclear annihilation. She should be saying the fear of it. But there was, of course, the Hiroshima and Nagasaki annihilations. The real nuclear annihilation is that which is to come. But I would say far more wounding is the mind control and the mass psychosis that has shown that the human species itself has now become a slave species. The crown of creation has fallen. The crown has fallen off. And we have been taken over by a power that is not understood, but that in human inauthenticity and ignorance has now the control over the destiny of the planet is now in other hands than human. And so it's the flight from death karmically forces the hand of death to return. We cannot avoid facing what we have run away from and facing the fact that the ego structure's failure to include the whole, failure to surrender to the whole, but failure also to accommodate wholeness. And what we could say are the internal contradictions in every human heart and in every human complex of energies, let's say. So we could say every being is at least split into yin and yang. Okay, and that yin and yang is not simply an external split, that one being is yang and another is yin. What we understand is that we have reached a point where the identifications of consciousness and of the body are out of sync with one another. And one way to put that would be that if most of the women in the Western world were honest, they would all want transgender operations because they actually identify much more on the masculine side, not on the feminine. And that phallic masculinity that most people with female bodies have is a defense. And either they use the feminine object for what it can get in terms of its desirability, or it will be rejected and it will be disfigured in some way, so that the masculine energies are dominant and are visibly, physically made so. At the same time, if most of the males were honest, they would admit that their gender is actually a toxic femininity, an effeminate lack of the phallus. How many can relate to that? Some, okay, that's good. Some beings who are willing to recognize this. But it's this gender inauthenticity that is almost universal and is not like something to blame. It's simply that the energies have shifted into their opposite modalities from their natural unity in terms of consciousness and its vehicle. And so we now have a situation where this has become a cultural shift as well, which has destroyed the last, terminus in which yin and yang could come together and merge into a purified love that brings both into the wholeness of the Tai Chi, of the Wu Ji, that enables a transcendence of gendered consciousness, which is in itself an inauthentic, because an incomplete mode of living in the world as a being manifesting the presence of God, because there will always be a search for that God, for the Shiva Lingam, for the goddess externally. And the truth that the Shiva Lingam must be accepted through an internal surrender, not an external one, that shifts the way that one relates to the world, and that this can only happen after the death of the ego, through the death of the ego. But otherwise, one will be living a life that will be directed by a desire to appear a certain way, through acting in ways that offer signifiers of saintliness, of egolessness, of transcendence, that are simply within the code of the egoic vocabulary that that signals a lack, but it's a lack of capacity to think the real of one's being, the lack of the capacity to accept that there is no other who will be able to fill the void, whether of the yin or the yang, that is lacking within. And that if one did have a sex change operation, it would make no difference, because the actual power of the lingam is not anatomically based, nor is it psychologically based. It's based in a shift from subjectivity to the substantiality of that which is unborn and that which has no internal contradictions. And the ego and the soul both are, with the soul we wouldn't say so much it's contradictory within itself, but it is in a state of complementarity to the self, and requires a final level of surrender before the authentic self is realized. So as she says on this first page, we are in the grip of immense experiential changes which both create and reflect new philosophical perspectives. These must be brought into the open if we are not to drift metaphysically blind from one concrete issue to another. And so I would say that this is the issue. We are in a state of metaphysical blindness. And this blindness is a willful blindness. And so it makes us want to deal with life in terms of concrete thinking, in terms not of contradiction, but simply of differences. But to not be able to understand the significance of those differences. As she says, the death that we face now, unlike the Black Death in Europe in the Middle Ages, is a calculated, deliberately brought about mass death of the species. And it is, as she says, threatening us with I'll just read it. Yet the true scale is vaster still, the ever-present danger of the irreversible null point, the destruction of all human life, probably emptying the immense cosmic spaces forever of that thinking reed who alone, Pascal claimed, apprehends them. So this null point, this null point indicates that she does not have a sense that there is a God, that there is a supreme intelligence who is superintending this disaster and turning it into a blessing. And so her fear, which comes from an atheistic belief system, which is the only one an academic is allowed to have, is that this is the end. It's just barren, empty space. The earth will be a rock, a radioactive rock, floating in the solar system without life, or even blown apart like the asteroid belt, and that life will simply be rooted out. That life itself has only a contingent relationship to the cosmos. And she, on page XI 11, she calls the human self a cognition monad. And I think this is one of the keys to the authenticity problem. This is, of course, the idea of René Descartes. I think, therefore I am, and focusing on the thinking capacity. But what about the feeling capacity? And what about the fact that we are united or at least entangled in a quantum, if not a qualium, web of a morphogenetic field? We are not just monads that have no windows, that have no connection with one another. There is a unifying field in which we all have our origin and our destiny. And so she's leaving that out of all of her factoring about this. And there's something else here that she talks about, which is the willingness of Hegel and Heidegger to show the importance of death, but also that each has shaken off the allergy to concrete history which has plagued modern philosophy since Descartes. But there's a catch-22 about that. And the reason is that most people's understanding of history is totally inauthentic. Even recent history, even the history of World War II and the Holocaust, has been mythologized and taken out of its true contextualization. And so history can lie. And most people have a view of history that they were indoctrinated into, in which we are making progress from primitive, you know, ignorant cavemen and women into modern high-tech geniuses, etc. This whole progress mythology, as if that was the true story of history. But it's all false, as is the Darwinian paradigm that starts from some illusion of, you know, protoplasm taking off into life because of some lightning bolt hitting primitive Earth or something. All of these views of so-called history are delusions. So I want to read something from a book by a man named Paul DeMann. If I can find the quote that I'm looking for. The book is called Blindness and Insight, Essays in the Rhetoric of Contemporary Criticism. And Paul DeMann discovered, and this was back in the 60s at the latest, that all of these lit crit books, all of the books that attempted to analyze literature, poetry, history, philosophy, etc., all of them were inauthentic, not just one or two. And his insights and those of a colleague of his named Jacques Derrida became the basis of a movement called deconstruction, which was hated throughout the academic world because, indeed, it pointed out the inauthenticity of academic writing. But it's not only academic writing; it's poetry as well. It's the literature itself. It's the novels, which themselves present false views of characters, presenting them as if they are substantial and non-contradictory beings very often, when this is not the case with the modern and postmodern ego structure with all of its dissociated fragments. It's rare, if ever, that a modern novel or a poet can present the truth of their own consciousness in a text. And so Paul de Man writes in one of his essays in this book, referring to the kind of essays being written by critics, including Marxist critics as well as those who are, you know, part of the Western canon, like Lukács, Blanchot, Poulet, or any of the others that are so famous. He says, the contradictions, however, never cancel each other out, nor do they enter into the synthesizing dynamics of a dialectic. No contradiction or dialectical movement could develop because a fundamental difference in the level of explicitness prevented both statements, if there are contradictory statements in an essay, from meeting on a common level of discourse. The one always lay hidden within the other as the sun lies hidden within a shadow, or truth within error. The insight seems instead to have been gained from a negative movement that animates the critic's thought, an unstated principle that leads his language away from its asserted stand, perverting and dissolving his stated commitment to the point where it becomes emptied of substance, as if the very possibility of assertion had been put into question. Yet it is this negative, apparently destructive labor that led to what could legitimately be called insight. So there is something extraordinarily important to be gained from reading an inauthentic text, and that is that it mirrors your own inauthenticity. Every ego judges and hates the inauthenticity of other egos. And most of its conscious life is engaged in internally hating and judging and putting down the other for their inauthenticity. But it almost never looks at its own. Almost never. And it almost never can look at its own, because its own inauthenticity is buried so deeply that it can only appear in the form of the other. How many can relate to that? Okay, we have an honest group. There's hope. Because until we have done that, until we have broken through our own defensive barrier to seeing our internal contradictions, we can never go about the real task of creating the philosopher's stone, the alchemical process that turns subject into substance, the divine substance, the philosopher's stone being the Shiva Lingam, being that absolute self that is wholeness and that is without alloy. So in her preface, she makes a few points that I think are totally wrong. Number one, she says, "I maintain that despite its rich diversity, the Western philosophical tradition is fairly well agreed upon its view of death and the meaning of self." I don't think that's true at all. Quite the opposite. She does say that there's rich diversity, but if there's rich diversity, then how can you also say that there's agreement? There isn't. You see the contradiction within that one sentence? It can't be both. But she's trying to say, despite the rich diversity, there's nothing to see here. There's actually a unified understanding, but there isn't. And it's very important that we understand that there is not. That's an ideological position that we have been indoctrinated into, all of us, even if we think we have broken away from it, but aspects of it will continue to haunt our consciousness. And for that belief system, death is the coming to an end of a self conceived as a cognition monad. But I don't think most beings actually have that view of themselves. And so she starts out with what I would call an absurd claim. If I can read my own writing here. Oh, yeah. Well, I won't get into Zeno's paradox right today because that's in a later chapter, but I think she totally misuses that idea. And, of course, she's talking about the death event as if it's something that takes place in a limited context rather than an unlimited one. And at the end of the preface, she says, scholarly studies of the meaning of death in Hegel and Heidegger abound. I'm not going to deal with that, she says. Instead, I shall try to interrogate their work freshly and without inhibition from the perspective of the theme of man-made mass death in the present age. Thus, I must pass over in silence issues relevant to the understanding of each thinker's work as a whole. But you see, I would say that if you don't understand their work as a whole, then you can't understand any of the parts. And so she's in a way forgiving herself and justifying not dealing with the essential wholeness of the perspective that Hegel in particular is offering regarding how and why we have fallen into inauthenticity and have brought about the end of our own species existence. We have made ourselves become extinct. As we are making all of the entire planetary ecosystem extinct. I'm probably not going to be able to get through even the first chapter, but let me get through a little bit of it. I think it's important that she opens with an epigraph from John Milton, who says, "I fled and cried out, Death! Hell trembled at the hideous name, and sighed from all her coves, and back resounded death." All right? But let me ask you, does death live in hell? You see, Milton's metaphor that death is something horrifying and lives in hell, and death means we are going to hell, is itself a symptom of how we have fallen into inauthenticity. The fear of death. Why do we fear death? It's not natural that we fear death. Animals don't fear death. The fear of death comes because we have a false life. and we cannot face the judgment of the falseness. It's not death that we fear that's hellish, it's truth. Okay, so that maybe that's the point I want to leave you with this evening. But she goes on and on about, is there an art of dying which is useful in this time and circumstance? But it's not about how to die, it's about how to live. And she says here also falsely that the present situation emerges from a new horizon, one so vastly different from what we have historically inherited that the phenomena which appear against it seem to make no sense. That's totally fraudulent. The entire history of the West is based upon the book of Revelations and the coming apocalypse. All of Western history is preparation for that. And the same is true. That same apocalypse is predicted in the Quran. It's certainly in the Torah, and in many ways it's prefigured in Sodom and Gomorrah and in the flood and in the Exodus, etc., etc. What do you mean there's no precedent for this? All of our lives and history and spirituality has been preparation for what we are now facing. But because in this last postmodern period, we have denied our whole history, our whole spirituality, we have denied that these revelations, that these prophecies had any validity to them, then we're taken by surprise. But is the surprise authentic? Or is that part of the lie that we have been living that is being exposed now? So again, she diverts into the art of death, and she wants the death world to be made up of mini cosmoi of the living dead embedded in larger societies. But today the whole world is Catherine Austin Fitz says, a digital concentration camp, where everyone is being connected to the cloud, often internally through the injection and the 5G and all of that that's happening. It's not just concentration camps happening in remote places. We are in a concentration camp. And if we deny the fact of that, then we certainly will not be able to live or die authentically. Moreover, she goes into this idea of moral failures. If you're a good man, she says, you won't fear death. But what is a good man? I won't even go into the gendered aspect of that. But she deals with it as if it's so easy to be a good person. There's hardly anyone, I think, who could claim to be a good person. For one thing, because goodness is presented by morality since Kant, by the way. And even though Hegel overcame that, Hegel rejected his idea. But Kant's idea is that morality is an ought. You ought to do this. If you're a good person, you have to do this, this, and this. It's a rule-based morality of perfectionism, that no one can meet the standards of what you ought to do. Not even a saint can meet those standards. So everyone is going to feel guilty and feel not good enough if they are truly, and I would even say authentically from within the ego perspective, trying to follow the mitzvot of the Torah or the command of Jesus, love your neighbor as yourself. Is anybody doing that or any of the other commandments? And of course, nobody loves themselves, so maybe they are loving their neighbor as themselves. But that's not very authentic either. So, and then she talks about death as a wound, but is it really a wound? And that So life in turn can be lived with integrity only if death is already accepted as inseparable from it. Death is the wound life bears in itself. She's right with the first half of that sentence. But is death a wound? You see, to immediately to consider it a wound is to assume that death is the end of consciousness, and that it's the loss of everything of value, because our value is only within life, within the phenomenal plane, and that our life with God between these phenomenal expeditions into Maya does not have value. So there's a completely one-sided failure to understand the truth about death. So how can you have a good death if you take death as something terrifying and wounding? Now here's somebody on my with an authentic bug's eye view of it all. So there was a time when in the U.S., one of the great mottos was live free or die. And people really took living free seriously. And it was only because of that that there could even have been a revolution that people were willing to die for. Not that it was authentic freedom, since it was limited to a very few, not to women or to the slaves, obviously. But the whole idea of our living free or dying, the idea that we have the courage to stand up for truth and for living in freedom is almost an extinct notion now. And so the cowardice, Hamlet said, conscience makes cowards of us all, but it's actually the lack of consciousness of the real that makes cowards of us all, because the ego, being false, cannot face the real or the truth of its being. So there's there's a lot of errors in the way that she tries to understand goodness. She says here on page 4 in the middle of the second paragraph, it is consistent with both views of death. I'll go back. Both death as nothingness and death as separation of the soul from the body offer similar psychological and moral gains. First, the assurance that suffering comes to an end, for even if the process of dying is painful, it too shall pass. And second, that dying is not an evil thing. It is consistent with both views of death to hold that evils occur only when the norms of conduct are violated, but do not occur fortuitously or as the result of natural events. Okay, there is no harm in the true sense may befall the good man in this life or in any other, if there is another, all right? But is goodness the same as the norms of conduct? I don't think so. I think the norms of conduct in the world today are anything but an expression of goodness. And so anyone who wants to be normal by definition is not good. They're in mass formation psychosis, in fact. And so if you take the norms of conduct as your criteria for your own goodness and how you will face death, you're going to have a very inauthentic view that will not stand the real judgment that you'll face at death, which is not about having followed all the conventional norms and all the rules and been good according to some external criteria of goodness. No. Authenticity is a much deeper understanding of reality that does not fit into any system of rules, including rules that call themselves dharma. It's only the purification of love in accord with wisdom that can even understand what is a real goodness and the capacity to live an authentic life. So it's not death, but the pain of truth that we have to really face. And not to be disturbed by the oughts of whatever lists of commandments that we're told that we have to follow. Because love can't be commanded, right? Even though it's in the Bible, thou shalt love thy Lord thy God with all thy heart. Can you really command that? You see, that in itself is an inauthentic expression. So we have even inauthenticity in our most sacred texts, let alone in the texts of academics at the end of the Kali Yuga. Well, there's a lot more in this. She attacks Hegel in some ways by saying, in two generations succeeding Hegel, the perceived limitations of his system were seen to derive from what was believed to be his conception of an all-inclusive and fatally bloated absolute. His absolute is not bloated. I'm sorry, that's a horrifying statement. It's the ego that's bloated. Hegel had, indeed, as we will see, a very accurate view of the absolute, one that could not be tolerated, which is why Hegel was very quickly forgotten and turned into everything but what he said, like Marxism and all other perverted versions of Hegelian thought. All of it is a failure to see that it's not physical death that's the issue, but ego death. And if we're not willing to go through that while alive, then we will not have achieved what is at least necessary, if not sufficient, for leading an authentic life. And that's really what we have to focus on, not the physical death that is not a wound. And here she says something very interesting also that I think is false. That individual death could become a theme for philosophical reflection and go proxy for other issues only when the radical contingency of thought itself was brought to the fore, when thinking was seen to depend upon something more primordial than itself, the existence of the thinker. In other words, the bodily existence of the thinker. Speculative thought thus became the mask which had to be torn away from existence, not in order to understand existence, but in order to expose its fragility. I would say the truth is the opposite of that, that by tearing away our capacity for speculative thought, which to me is thought of the higher real, is what, when we have torn that away, we are hiding the fragility of our ego. Because we exist as consciousness prior to our existence as bodily beings. And that's the nature of what has to be made fully authentic and genuine in a sense of being wise and loving. So if I ask you, is a dream that you have at night, is it an experience or is it a concept? Isn't the dream presenting a conceptual understanding of how you are living inauthentically that you are not able to get while you're in the waking state? And the dream is giving a correction to that inauthenticity. You see, it's a concept. It's not an experience. And until we understand that, we cannot understand that the phenomenal waking dream is also conceptual, not primarily experiential. The experiential aspect of life is imaginary. It's the symbolic that is primary over the imaginary, and the symbolic is only there as a portal to the supreme real. If we do not have those aspects of reality clarified, we will not be able to live authentically. She doesn't even get close to this. Her three-tiered reality is just about, you know, vegetables and then animals and then social life. You know, she doesn't even begin to get into the spiritual dimension in her paradigm. And so, therefore, the ground in which a true discourse of authenticity could be discussed or debated with someone using this kind of a paradigm does not even arise. You see, it's off the table. It's not within the paradigm. If we do not have a radical paradigm shift, then the real questions that we have to ask ourselves and the real lacunae of lack that produce our drives, our longings, as Rilke often puts it, all of our desires, where they come from is always a lack of being, a lack of truth, a lack of the real. And if we don't get that, then we can never lead lives in which we have released ourselves from the externalization of a lack that only creates a karmic backlash of further suffering rather than the capacity to live in a state of grace. Okay, I'll stop there. We'll have to continue chapter one next week. Has this been useful to anybody? Yeah, I hope so. So it's a prologue to a lot of many more deep issues that, because she gets them wrong, she gives us an opportunity to try to get them right. And so therefore, I appreciate the book very much. But it really has to be read critically and dialectically and not naively, and not taking her as some expert who has the gospel that now enables you to, you know, live authentically. Because if you do that, again, you'll just be borrowing and imitating ideations that are not connected to the real. And then, of course, no actual transformation can take place. So I'd like to continue next week by actually going into Rilke more deeply and reading some of Rilke's poems, not just a few lines from them, but some whole poems, to get a sense of Rilke's struggle with authenticity that I think is the basis from which we can all move into higher states of consciousness if we read Rilke with... let's say with the willingness to recognize his own struggle with his own inauthenticity, and I think this is very important. Maybe I should quote one more point in this first chapter. Let's see, wait a minute. When she quotes Rilke here on page 11, "True, it is strange to inhabit the earth no longer, to use no longer customs scarcely acquired, not to interpret roses and other things that promise so much in terms of a human future, and to lay aside even one's proper name like a broken toy. Yes, but all of the living make the mistake of drawing two sharp distinctions. Angels, they say, are often unable to tell whether they move among living or dead." So first of all, he's saying he doesn't really know about angels. Angels, they say, right? It's hearsay. It's not direct knowledge. He's admitting that he is not yet on close terms with the angels, even though He's constantly writing about the angels, but he says very often they're terrifying. And he can't stand too much of the presence of the angel because the angel represents truth. And it's the truth that all of the distinctions one makes, those pairs of opposites, this is right, this is wrong, this we should do, this we shouldn't, all of these distinctions, they're a mistake. Because there's a contradictoriness that has to be reconciled in anything that one does within the phenomenal plane, that is always only a half saying and a half doing, because the other aspect of the real is only located in the dimension of death that the ego finds unspeakable. So whatever our interpretation is of roses or orchids or birds or trees or whatever we find beautiful, sunsets, all of that, it's an interpretation that supports a false existence. And we have to go beyond interpretation to see things as they really are. At some point, he says, the only thing that we will be remembered for is saying things like jug, house, different aspects of things in his life. I forget where this is located in the text. Oh yeah, are we perhaps here just for saying house, bridge, fountain, gate, jug, olive tree, window, right? Is that all that's authentic in our lives? You see, there's nothing human that's authentic. It's just those things. And then he says, but those things are no longer even authentic. An American house is not a real house. An American bridge is not. You know, everything coming from the New World is phony. It's fake. He says that in here. Now from America, empty, indifferent things are pouring across. Sham things, dummy life. They're sham because it is for the things as it is for us. When the death in things, not the death produced by them, but the death that is in them is shut out, they can only be meaningless mechanical objects. So we now live in a mechanical, technological world that has no soul. And it's that soullessness that has contaminated our own consciousness and that has taken over the world. And if we, here she says something also, a contradiction in this next paragraph. In one sentence she says, for Rilke, the renewal of the world will come about through poetry. He doesn't say that. And then she says, three sentences down, for Rilke, wholeness is no longer possible. Because he reminds us the terrifying thing is we possess no religion in which our lower chakras could be sublimated into the higher, basically. So she says one thing and then another. Poetry will not save us. What we have to go through this death. We possess no religion. What does religion mean here? It's not a belief system, but no actual connection to God, to the self, that can lift us out of our own false consciousness. And as she quotes Hegel, only a God can save us now. And then she says at the bottom of page 9, although we cannot restore the gods to the world, we can at least refrain from living as if life consisted of grasping finished patterns already built into existence. In other words, we need a paradigm shift. But why can't we restore the gods to the world? Why does she make that assumption that we can't do it? That's exactly what we have to do. And that would be the only way to live authentically. But dare we take on that task? That's the real question. Do we dare? And to dare, we have to recognize that only if we have the courage to live free or die is life worth living at all. Okay, I'll end there. Floor is open.
Thank you, Shunya. First a question, and then I want to speak about a few of the points from the book. something that stood out to me while reading, she mentioned that though there was no necessary ends to it in the bringing over of slaves and...
Sure, and the killing of all the American Indian tribes, also quite calculated. I agree.
Okay. Yeah.
So, yeah, it didn't begin in World War One.
Right, because all of the things that she was talking about in terms of being able to extricate someone from their familiar surroundings and throw them into a new environment and systematically like deprive them of retaining any culture or anything like that.
Sure.
Okay.
You could go back even further and find it in, back in Alexander the Great's time, you could find that. But definitely it became worse and worse. It became much more genocidal as time went on.
Okay, a couple of points from the book, or from this chapter. The first one was that discussion of the authenticity paradigm. I always find it useful to bring up this point of death and this whole discussion of Socrates. I read that first little section with trepidation and anxiety of realizing that I don't have death constantly in mind in the sense of a final coming to terms with one's inauthenticity. So I did find that useful. The second point was this, I don't know how she described it exactly, but basically decentering. It was when she started talking about Rilke and pulling oneself from the figure of the tapestry into another part of it in which one can look upon it from a different perspective, which I took to mean from the perspective of like the unlived or the dead or that which we're unwilling to recognize. I think the unmanifest. I don't know if that's what she was talking about, but that's how I took it.
It's interesting that she chose Socrates, who died a kind of a secular death. Indeed, I think he was released from the ego. But she didn't mention Christ. She didn't mention any of the Christian mystics. She didn't mention anyone whose life was lived in an authentic spiritual, not just philosophical mode of expression. So I think that, again, is she wants to stay away from any of that territory because, you know, her discourse would break up if she accepted the validity of that. But Rilke does, by the way.
Rilke does.
Yeah, Rilke does. He's not a Christian of an orthodox kind. In fact, his main inspiration is Nietzsche. But he talks about Christ and about the angels and about God very directly. He wants to avoid dogma because he wants the truth. He doesn't want it, filtered through biblical metaphors. But he's very much in tune with that. So I think his approach of accepting the transcendental nature of consciousness is not the aspects of his work that she quotes. She avoids it.
Yes, I don't know much of Rilke, so I'm glad we'll be delving into that more. But the little that I've read is very powerful. Even some of the phrases that she quoted and this whole point of acknowledging that death is always present in life, I found very powerful. The discussion of... one of the things I found most interesting was this whole discussion of the institution of science and the ideas of reason and the Enlightenment, quote-unquote, and all of that in the sense of transforming our world into one in which qualia and quality itself is recognized into this mathematical reductionism into quantities. Mm-hmm. And, we could talk about money and all of those sorts of things, but like this whole, where it leads to is turning human beings into quantities that can then be dispensed with and...
Yeah, I think the perennial philosophers like Evola and others have been talking about that for a long time. And she doesn't quote any of those, you notice. But nonetheless, I think that's an accurate point.
Yeah, these academics never quote the perennial philosophers, right? They're too
very rare.
Taboo.
Yeah.
And this whole point of, I think, the death world... And I did find it very powerful, this whole discussion and these testimonies of people who lived through this. She also, well, speaking of Lacuna, didn't mention this gentleman that we watched a few videos on, student of Aurobindo, who lived through and had a very different experience than any of the people that she quoted, right?
Indeed, Sat Prem.
That's okay, that's who I thought it was. I wasn't sure. So there was that, but just getting in this mode of which everything is, meaning is destroyed, and the only relation that one has is this sort of zombified death and life. Mm-hmm. I asked you like years ago, probably like 10 years ago, about what is the death drive of like different levels of consciousness, and we were talking about the death drive of the sensor. And you told me it was a death in life. It's pure mm-hmm. zombie consciousness, and that's what it seeks.
That's right. But so let me just say there, consciousness has two ends to its spectrum. The lower end, it dissolves in ignorance and spacing out and total tamasic, not wanting to know anything about consciousness, anything about meaningfulness or reality, and that the upper end, it reaches absolute knowing where it transcends thought. So thought is the middle level of the spectrum. You can space out and lose thought at the lower end, or you can transcend thought at the higher end. But those are very different deaths of the thinking apparatus. And one is a total lack, and the other is the reaching the source of intelligence itself, that because it knows everything simultaneously, can't be put into words. Okay.
And then I think there was one more thing about this whole discussion of the death world. I'm not recalling it right now. But anyway, the whole point of moving into this paradigm in which people are governed by this total lack of any sort of meaning, which growing up in the world today, it was funny that you were talking about Rilke and everything coming from the real world is, the new world is phony, right? Because I grew up feeling everything is fake. Mm-hmm. It's all a lie mm-hmm. at every level. And it leads to this sort of nihilism that's mm-hmm. then being brought about at ever more increasing and evident levels. Mm-hmm. So anyway, mm-hmm. there's maybe a few more points, but I think that's good enough for all tonight. Right. Thank you for the presentation. Mm-hmm. I look forward to the next discussion.
Great. Thank you for those astute points. Sat Prem.
Yeah, thank you. I'm taking advantage of the microphone being so close. And I'm super happy that you're approaching this book in this way, because me reading it, I was actually quite confused finding her that she is talking so much about the Western approach to death and not really considering the Eastern world approach at all. She's like, whenever she gets closer to an interesting point, she just avoids it. Mm-hmm. And the book is written from the approach of like death is something to be feared, and someone who has the courage to deal with death in a way that he can find peace, knowing that there might be some kind of an afterlife or something like that, but not really seeing that death is a liberating thing. Mm-hmm. Well, anyways, so the few points that I wanted to, that I really liked, Purusha touched on it as well, is she said that mass death of humans, it's like the division, many people died, but without thinking of how they're going to come back, or without the fear that there will be enough possibility for all the humans to come back. So there is one point I want to explore in my contemplations further, and also the death world and the language that people that the mass destructors use in order to create a field where people are not they're alive, but they already are believed to be dead. So that's another point that is interesting for me to contemplate. How can that feel to be living in a field where I know that I don't have any future other than liberation, basically, and no hopes, nothing like that. So yeah, interesting book. I'm looking forward to reading more, and I'm looking forward to Rilke as well.
Great. Okay, and keep noticing her contradictions, because it's in those that the real appears and points to a deeper dimension of what remains unspoken. But good points. Anyone else before we adjourn? Yeah. Go ahead. Orvishi. Yeah.
Well, I have many questions, but your teaching clarified a lot of them, so thank you. And this is quite a random one that maybe won't make sense. But so if language is inauthentic, obviously, and there's a point in the book where she's talking about how pain leads to, like the shock of mass death leads to a total loss of the capacity to use words. And it reminded me of in the film Threads, where towards the end no one can speak and they have this weird language and no one... they can't really communicate properly. And the question is almost related to when there's a shock and that's how the light gets in, like when in the case of I can't really describe this, but in a mass traumatic event, when language degrades because of shock, is there also then the capacity to totally transcend that inauthentic?
Is there a capacity?
Does that leak? Can that create an opportunity?
Yeah, I actually think it's all this whole mass trauma is awakening us. It's not deadening us. It's actually awakening us from a life that had been zombified, and now the pressure of realizing that real death is coming—not just death in life, in authentic existence, but the end. For everyone of an almost unthinkable nature, but it wakes one up to the sense of awe as to what is actually undergoing an emergence into this field of something totally shocking and yet something that's totally enlivening to our intelligence.
That explains exactly what I meant. And also, I was wondering, it's a bit random, but so many kids these days have Tourette's, like so many kids, it's like this massive epidemic, and it's really severe, and it really seems almost demonic, like they're possessed. And obviously that's the opposite of what you've just said, but is that just a sign of the times, or what's happening when...
Yeah, it's one of many symptoms of split consciousness, in which a certain amount of hatred and fury breaks through, and there's no control over it. The subconscious is way too powerful for the conscious mind to hold in place according to the norms of conduct. The primitive forces of the id have broken through, and there's no defense. Henrietta, do you have something you wanted to add?
I didn't know that you want to go into Rilke, but since Rilke was an Austrian poetic, yeah. I looked out one of his poems, and I had the idea to read it in German and then to read it in English.
Yes, I actually wanted to do that in a separate meeting next time.
Will
you won't be here next week. Oh, dear. this is terrible. I do want to do it, but it's late to start it now for this class. But I was going to ask if you would do that. But we also have, you could read it in German, mm-hmm. also, Anandi, yes. But I think we have to wait until the next meeting.
It's no problem.
But if you want to read some in German, just to give us a sense of the beauty of the language, what would you read from the Duino Elegies?
The Little Death.
What's that?
The Little Death.
The Little Death, go ahead.
Der kleine Tod. Mm-hmm. Ich kann nicht glauben, dass der kleine Tod... dem wir doch täglich übern Scheitel schauen, uns eine Sorge bleibt und eine Not. Ich kann nicht glauben, dass er ernsthaft droht. Ich lebe noch, ich habe Zeit zu bauen. Mein Blut ist länger als die Rosenrot. Mein Sinn ist tiefer als das witzige Spiel mit unserer Furcht, darin er sich gefällt. Ich bin die Welt, aus der er irrend fiel. Wie er. Kreisende Mönche wandern so umher, man fürchtet sich vor ihrer Wiederkehr. Man weiß nicht, ist es jedes Mal derselbe? Sind's zwei, sind's zehn, sind's tausend oder mehr? Man kennt nur diese fremde, gelbe Hand, die sich ausstreckt, so nackt und nah. Da, als käme sie aus dem eigenen Gewand.
Do you want to read it in English?
Should I read it?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I can't believe that the little death over whose head we are looking every day is still a worry to us and an affliction. I can't believe that it really looms. I still live. I have time to build. My blood is longer than the rose is red. My thoughts are deeper than the clever game with our fear in which it takes pleasure. I'm the world from which death, a rent fell. Like death, circling monks wander around. One is afraid of their returning. One doesn't know. Is it the same one every time? Are there two? Are there 10,000 or more? One knows only this unfamiliar yellow hand, outstretched, so naked and so near. That one there, as if coming out of its own robe.
Okay, beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
We will continue reading Rilke, and possibly some also in German, but I want to read actually several different English translations so you can see how inauthentic some of the translations are, and because translation is a field in which a work of art can be turned into many different variants of itself in a way that... causes it to have and make entirely different impressions and different implications about reality than the original. So we're reaching a very subtle nuance of language, and when you try to switch from one language to another, so much is lost. And so much is turned into a very different texture of meaning that cannot be found in the language that you're translating into, because each language is its own world in a way, and so that capacity to interrelate between worlds also affects us with every relationship we're in, because we're always translating. Each one has a different private language. And even though the words seem common, but there's no longer a common sense in which all the words have the same significance for everyone. Common sense has been lost. And because of that, misunderstanding is almost universal. And so to have an authentic meeting of minds and hearts hardly ever happens, because the miscommunication always creates a slight glitch at some point. Hopefully we can overcome that here through the purification of love and wisdom. Anyway, I hope this has been helpful, and that reading this book is enlivening your intellect and creating an interest in discovering what is the true source of authenticity, and finding the power to live a life which is true to your highest self. Namaste.
Namaste.
Remind me to talk to you a little bit more about Paul de Man at some place. He's a very interesting figure. And the question of his authenticity is is one that will, I think, enlighten us as to an entirely different understanding of what greatness of soul really is. So anyway, let's keep our minds open without judgment.